Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. Today's episode is going to begin our conversation about soils. In this episode, I want to look at the soil and its structure, beginning with how it's formed, the textures to look for, and lastly, the soil horizons. Over the next couple of episodes, I'm going to expand on this and include a conversation on pH, both what it is as well as how it affects our plants, soil nutrients, both macro and micro, overall, what makes for healthy soil, what problems we face that can lead to damaged or degraded soil, and finally to start thinking about how, as designers, we can work with these issues we face and correct any problems and make it more suitable towards building a permanent culture. Throughout it will be various methods for how to test the soil, and many of these are on-the-ground exercises you can do outside in the world by going, digging, getting your hands dirty, and experiencing. Hopefully, at the same time, you'll also be expanding your understanding of soil along the way. Before we get into any of that, though, if you haven't already, please share this show with someone, whether that means mentioning it in your Facebook status, to your circle on Google, in your blog, a website or forum you frequent, or just sending a link to a friend. Please help get the word out there. I want to be able to spread the word of permaculture far and wide. It's become my mission as a permaculturist to do this, and I ask you, my much-beloved listeners, to give me a hand in doing that. It'll really help. If you haven't already visited the website lately, please stop by thepermaculturepodcast.com and take a look around. As I find news, videos, and other material, I'm placing it there so that it is easier for people to find. I'm also beginning to put up more of my own material, some spreadsheets and documents that might be useful in your own work. Updates like this occur a few times a week, so go and check it out. You might see something you haven't before that gives you a new perspective on this bold new world of intentional, integrated ecological design. While you're there, also check out the new membership page. There you can sign up to help support the show. Finally, after asking all that of you, I'd like to give something else to you in addition to the show. If at any point in your journey you have any questions, comments, or anything that you would like to share with me, please feel free to contact me. Email is usually the best way, the address show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, but it's not the only way. You can also give me a call. And that number is 717-798-8100. Though I'm not always around, leave a message and I'll get back to you, because I really do want to help you on your permaculture journey in any way that I can. So then, what shall we discuss about soils? I want to begin with the very basic. What is soil? My favorite definition comes from WordNet. And though it has the same meaning as our good friends at Webster's, this is a bit more pleasant, though basic just the same. Soil. Material in the top layer of the surface of the earth in which plants can grow, especially with reference to its quality or use. That middle portion about in which plants can grow, to me, is one of the important distinctions that separates soil from dirt. Plants must be able to grow in it, and part of our work as designers, as I'll get into in the other episodes about soil, is in maintaining and building it so that it can support ever more diverse and complex ecosystems. And it may require years of work. I'm in this process at the moment, myself, and I'm expecting that I probably have another 2 or 3 years of soil building until I'm comfortable with what I have. But we'll get to that. The soil, this skin of the earth, helps us to grow our plants, provide food for us. And that seems simple enough, but how does it form, and what are its structure and layers? The process of soil formation occurs through something known as weathering. And this is where mechanical and chemical reactions break bedrock down into ever smaller particles. Mechanical weathering simply breaks them down, while chemical weathering can actually change the makeup of the parent rock and transform it into something different from what it started as, which could include softening or changing mineral content. If you've ever taken a hammer to a piece of stone and broken it, or seen a piece of shale as it comes apart into smaller pieces, that's really what mechanical weathering is doing. And if you've ever taken a chemistry class and poured acid on something, or even, say, vinegar on limestone and seen it bubble, those are the kinds of processes that come with chemical weathering. In either case, it's about breaking this big piece of rock into something much smaller. And as they get smaller, they get mixed with decomposing organic matter. Biological processes such as animals, plants, and people are all very efficient at mixing, moving, and continually integrating these various materials together, both the particles from the parent rock and the organic matter that comes in. Animals do it by their burrowing, tunneling, and digging. Plants send their roots out, which break it up and move it and push it. And of course, people, with all of our technology, we can move, mix, and change soil very rapidly just by pulling out heavy equipment or even a shovel. We can do a lot to really change the landscape around us. In addition to these bits of rock, including organic material and humus, the soil also contains air and water. How much of each is determined by the soil's texture, and that texture is determined by the size of the particles that make it up. When weathering occurs, the bits of rock can keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until we're left with the three main constituents, in order from smallest to largest, of clay, silt, and sand. Clay is really, 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 really tiny, 1/2000th of a millimeter or less, whereas silt's between that size of clay at 1/2000th of a millimeter up to about 1/500th of a millimeter, very, very small. But even at these sizes, you can feel the difference between your fingers if you were to rub some of these around between your fingertips. Sands are further divided into fine, medium, and coarse sands, with this overall class of particles being between 1/500th of a millimeter up to about 2 millimeters. And the proportion of these, clay to silt to sand, let us know what kind of soil we're working with. If you've ever heard of a loam, what might be considered a standard or an ideal soil, it's going to be around 20% clay, 40% silt, and 40% sand. From there we move out and away through things like clay loam, silt loam, sandy loam, to sandy clay, silty clay, until we go out to soils that are mostly one particle of clay, silt, or sand. There's a great diagram that shows all this that's arrayed as a triangle that you can read based on the percentages of these various particles, and I'll post a link to that in the show notes so you can check it out. Brings all this together pretty nicely. Armed with that chart, here are some simple tests you can do to determine what the texture of your soil is. The first is the ball test. For this, you want to go out and dig up some soil. About a half a handful will be enough. If it's really dry, wet it some. If it's really muddy, wait for the ground to dry out a little before you do this. What you're looking for is a nice, moist sample of soil. Now what you want to do is try and roll it into a ball in your hands. If you're rubbing it and it won't form a ball, take and rub some between your fingers. Does it feel gritty? Then this is likely a soil that contains a good bit of sand. If it forms a ball, take a little pinch, rub it between your fingers. If it falls apart into crumbs and has kind of a smooth, slick texture with a little bit of grit, which you can then recombine and roll back into a ball, probably something closer to a loam, a nice mix of clay, silt, and sand. And then there's the other side of this. If it forms a ball and you rub it between your fingers and it's smooth and sticky and kind of forms ribbons or smears across your fingers as you press it, this is a soil that contains a good bit of clay. And it's a nice quick field exercise just to give you a range of where it might be in the spectrum from sandy to clay. Another test, which is the first that I learned when working with soil and learning about its structure, is the jar test. And this test, you're going to need a large jar, about a quart or liter, with a tight-fitting lid, some clean water, a soil sample, about half the volume of your container, and some way to mark the jar. I've used tape, permanent markers, just any way that I can do to define some lines. But in your clean jar, you want to fill it about 3/4 of the way with water, and then add your soil sample until there's about 1 inch of airspace at the top. And as you're putting the dirt in, make sure that you're breaking it up any clumps that you find. Then put the lid on good and tight and shake the jar vigorously, just back and forth and all around it, for a couple of minutes until all the dirt's broken up and it's suspended. Now set the jar down in a place that it can remain for 24 hours and not be disturbed. It's not going to be picked up, shaken, handled, or anything like that, because you need to let it settle. Once you set it down in place, wait a minute, and then mark where the material has settled on the bottom. Just put a line at the top of that layer that's formed. This is the sand. Now wait about an hour, and then place your next mark. This is the silt that's settled out of the water. Now for this next part, you're going to have to wait until the next day. You're going to want to come back after around 24 hours, and you should see that there's a third layer on top of these other two, and that's the clay in the water. And that's the clay from the soil sample that's settled out of the water. Now, you may find kind of a fourth layer on top of this, or you'll see that the water hasn't completely cleared, that there's still stuff floating in there, or perhaps on the top of the water surface. This is mostly your organic matter. It's still kind of floating around, and that's all right. But what this test gives you is a fairly accurate profile of the material in your soil and their corresponding percentages. You can take from bottom to top, that represents 100% of your soil sample, and if you want to, you can pull out a ruler and measure how high it is, and then measure each layer of how thick they are and divide it all out, and that's going to give you a pretty precise reading. But you can also just eyeball it and make an informed guess that, oh, well, it's about 40% sand, 20% silt, and 40% clay. That's okay. This is just to give you a better idea of where this soil is in the spectrum. And I will say that if you're teaching this material to kids, this test is one of my favorites to do, because they're going to be wanting to take turns to just shake that jar and have a good time with it. In that case, I try to make sure I've got something that's not going to break. I've done this with my daughter just to let her have a go at it, and it's fun. It really gets kids involved. And those are two direct tests that you can do to check the texture. If you're interested, you can probably find a soil map for your area. There are plenty of these on the web. Just go to your favorite search engine and search for the phrase soil map, then follow that with your local region, name or postal code or some other identifier for your local area. For my home here in Pennsylvania, I was able to pull up an interactive map from Penn State University that allowed me to specifically locate my home and then see the basic profile for the ground beneath my feet. And it was interesting because I could see how quickly this soil profile changed across the area that I live in. The ground that I live on is supposed to be prime agricultural land, and then the stuff further up the hill is not, that it's degraded and not ideal. Of course, though, this is only going to give you a general idea of what the soil may be like based on the underlying bedrock and some other characteristics. You're going to want to go out and do these tests, both the ball test and the jar test, to get a more accurate reflection of what's there. If you want to, you could also send your soil sample off to a lab to do it, but so far in my work and everything else, I haven't seen a reason to send off soil for a texture test. It's just so easy to do it yourself. So why go into all this detail to understand what the texture of a soil is? It's because the texture of the soil lets us know some of the properties to expect when we're working on the ground. Soil with more sand is likely to drain faster, meaning they're more likely to be drier than a loam, and also not as fertile as a result of that because the nutrients are washed away or leached by water. Clay soils will hold water better, but they're more likely to become waterlogged, which can kill many plants. And though they hold minerals well, they may not be available to plants because the clay is difficult for the roots to penetrate, especially when it dries out and becomes hard. Our loam soils are somewhere in between the two, holding less nutrients than the clay, but more than the sand, doesn't drain as quickly as the sand, but does drain more quickly than the clay. What I like best about these tests, though, is that they're quick and inexpensive, helping to focus your efforts rapidly and for little to no money. I mean, if you have to buy a jar, you have to buy a jar, but it's only a few dollars, and you can probably find something that will be just as suitable around you, so that when you're out there observing a site, you have a place to start so that you can see patterns emerging about what plants you're likely to find growing in which type of soil. If you know that this sample of soil is sandy and you keep seeing these same arrangements of plants in that soil, it lets you build a profile of what you could include in a local design when you're faced with these kinds of soil conditions. And starting out here at the base with the texture and gaining a knowledge of these plants allows you to later use them in combinations to get a read on the potential soil conditions ahead of doing a test. You'll go out there and you'll see, oh, well, there's plants A, B, and C. I usually see those in a sandy soil. That's likely to be a sandy soil. These become your indicator plants for your area. And over time, you can build a profile of indicator plants for most of the soil conditions that you'll encounter, and go out and be able to look around and read the landscape. But as I mentioned, you know, going out and seeing plants A, B, and C, you want to make sure that you're looking for consistent communities of plants over time in an area, and not just rely on one or two when you go in to make an assessment. There are outliers, which might not fit the profile that you'll find, and also some plants are just going to grow across such a wide range of conditions that it makes them useless as indicators. Take your time, look for slow solutions, and build your knowledge as you go. You'll get there. Start with your soil textures. Find plants that grow in those textures in your area as your base, and then use the information that we'll get into in the future episodes about soil and plants, and build it up from there for more and more specific cases. Our soil tests give us an idea of the structure of the soil that we sample. But if you're to dig further down, you'll find that the soil changes as you go deeper. What you find at the surface may not be the same as 1, 2, or 3 feet deeper. Cut away a section straight down to the bedrock, and you'll see that the soil is separated out into layers, like you'd find in a cake. And these are known as the soil horizons. And there are numerous horizons depending on what sources you read. But for our discussion here, I'm going to cover 5 of the ones you're most likely to encounter. They're not the only ones, but these are the basic ones that keep coming up as I read and look into this topic. From all the different sources, these are the ones I keep seeing. Starting at the soil surface and moving down, they are O, A, B, C, and R. O is really on top of the soil, and it's where plant litter falls and decomposes, and worms leave their castings. It's mostly organic matter, and it could be a fraction of an inch to a few feet thick, depending on the amount of material that can accumulate there and how quickly decomposers move in and break it down. Beneath this is the A horizon, and is the beginning of what we might think of as our topsoil, and it's composed of weathered particles and humus, which is a stable form of decomposed organic matter that offers a variety of benefits to the soil. And I'll discuss humus in more detail in the next show. I'll give it its own little section. The A horizon is where you will find the majority of soil life. Earthworms, nematodes, fungi, bacteria. It can be many feet thick, though, depending on the conditions and if it's degraded, it may not exist at all. Beneath A is the B horizon, or subsoil, and it's going to be of a distinctly different consistency than the layer above. Due to the movement of minerals down from the O and A horizons via a process known as leaching, where minerals and salts that are water-soluble dissolve and are carried downward by the water, which also occurs more so through the chemical reaction with things like acid rains as well, this winds up leading to a buildup of minerals and salts in the B horizon, and plant roots can extend down into this. Well, my understanding is that the nutrients that have leached down to the B horizon aren't necessarily as accessible to our plants. They're going to be getting most of their nutrients from the A horizon. The C horizon, named mostly because it comes after the A and B, is the transitional layer between the upper, more biologically active horizons and the bedrock beneath. It's not part of the soil building process anymore because it's largely untouched by weathering. And it's this lack of soil building that's one of the defining features of this horizon. And it's going to be more of like a chunky texture. I think of chunky peanut butter, of all things, as I'm thinking about this, because it's not being broken down and it consists of these bits and pieces that are just sitting there waiting to be exposed, waiting to have this weathering process reach them. And lastly is the R horizon, which is the bedrock. And this forms the base where our soil rests upon its once weathered surface, once weathered because of the original soil building processes that broke it down to form the soil above it. It's a large continuous mass of stone, and breaking it apart and excavating it would require a great deal of time, energy, and equipment. You aren't going to be out there with a pick and a shovel and be expecting to do a lot of movement of the bedrock, as opposed to, say, the stones, rocks, and boulders that you might find in the horizons above. The bedrock is fairly monolithic. And those are the 5 basic soil horizons you're likely to encounter. And this knowledge of horizons is useful because it can help you get a better understanding of what you can do with a space, or if you're encountering problems that you just can't overcome, it's another place to look to have a better understanding. If your B horizon is only a couple of inches beneath your A and it's of a clay structure, then it may be holding so much water that your plant roots are getting drowned out because it's not draining quickly enough. Or you know where to look for mineral buildup if you see a certain deficiency in a plant or some other characteristics of a problem that you aren't able to quickly correct, knowing that the soil is structured into these layers. And if you dig, what to look for and how they change and what you might find, and the distinction between just finding a boulder or a big chunk of rock, and finding bedrock. Depending on where you are, what your conditions are, you may encounter issues like this more often than others. For me, I know that issues like that for a lack of depth isn't something that I necessarily need to be concerned about. However, as I've learned in my soil building process, my A horizon was more or less completely stripped off of my property. And as a result of that, a lot of what's known as fill was brought in that doesn't have the benefits of what we would normally find in the A horizon of of the organic matter and the humus, which is why I'm in the process of building my soil, so that I have something that can be more productive and useful to my needs. And I hope you can use this knowledge and information to do the same with the projects that you're working on. As I said at the beginning of this material on the soil horizons, depending on what you read or soil classification system you use, there are lots of soil horizons that can be described. I think I ran into one that was like 40 different soil horizons, and this discussion really only serves as a basic overview of this idea of soil stratification as an addition to the understanding of the structure of soil. As with any specialty, there's a lot more detail here if you want it, but acting within the generalist nature of permaculture, you'll want to choose what your level of engagement is with this information. If you have a lot of it, that's great. If you don't and you're in doubt about any of it, grab a specialist for more information. There are lots of folks out there who are soil scientists, agronomists. They do this kind of work day in and day out. And if you check with your local university, make a couple of phone calls, you can probably find somebody to ask some questions of. And if you're still scratching your head on this material about soil structure, you can find a list of links to additional resources for this show in the notes, or if you visit thepermaculturepodcast.com. For now, this is going to wrap up this basic information on soil structure that I wanted to cover. In the next episode, I'll move on to discuss pH, humus, soil nutrients, and what makes for healthy soil. I think then I'll make a separate show about the problems we face that lead to damaged or degraded soil, and then get us to start thinking about how to work with or correct those problems. Thank you for joining me again for another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. The next episode will be out in a couple of days. In between now and then, will be some little interludes and other material to whet your world of permaculture, including some music from Andrew Millison. You can learn more about him at beaverstatepermaculture.com. Until I talk to you again, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.